Pine, a kind of the Eminence Grise of fire. He works at ASU down in, I think he's down in Tempe, Arizona, and he's written probably 50 books about fire. He's a very eloquent guy, and he really looks at history and culture and science. He's the man, you know, as far as writing about fire, and so it's, you know, it's humbling to try to write about it after him. But he has written articles about this. He said it's like watching polio come back. Like, we learned this already. You don't build your house in the forest. You build a village, and you cut down everything all around it, and that's where you plant your crops, and that's where you graze your animals, and you got acres and acres and acres and acres before you get to the woodland, and you go to the woods to cut firewood. But if it catches on fire, you've got this massive fire break, which is your pasturage and planted fields. And so that a lot of places burned down in the 16th, 17th, and 18th and 19th centuries. People learned some really painful lessons, and also about what to build with. And, you know, a weird thing about, on top of our return to the forest, if you will, is what we build our homes out of. And there's a thing called a legacy home and a modern home. And a legacy home, made of wood, maybe it might have wood shingles, might have slate shingles. The mattresses, you know, might be full of cotton batting or horsehair or something like that. Well, that's not how they're built anymore. You would not believe the amount of petroleum products that are integrated into your house. And when they get hot, they burn like crazy. So talk to any firefighter. A legacy house burns much more slowly than a modern house. And I unpacked a video that the Underwriters Laboratories performed, where they compare a legacy living room to a modern living room. And it will scare the daylights out of you when you see how those things burn. And one of them burns really differently than the other one. And I bet you can guess. And that's what most of us live in now. And that's certainly Fort McMurray. You know, Petroleum Central, build them quick, build them fast, make them modern. And so there, you know, it's hard to realize how integrated the petroleum industry is into every aspect of our lives. And if you just think about the clothes you're wearing right now, you know, you're probably wearing quite a few petroleum products. And, you know, they're great. There's all kinds of advantages. But they all, at the root of it, is flammability. And this insight that I had, it's a little bit metaphysical, but I think it's worth saying, the petroleum industry is a wholly owned subsidiary of fire. And when you look at fire behavior on Earth, and when you look at the physics and chemistry of what happens and what is possible on Earth, it makes sense. And then when you think of these CEOs, you know, Darren Woods saying, yeah, at the end of the day, head of Exxon, at the end of the day, we're not an electron company, we're a molecule company. And the molecules he's talking about are short chain, sweet crude oil molecules. You know, yeah, we'll put up a windmill here if it makes you happy, but we're burners, and that's what we're going to do. And that's heavy, especially this summer.
I'd love to see if anybody in the audience has a question. Anybody like to raise their hand? We do have hands up. I believe there are microphones. And I don't know if I guess I just picked, so maybe we'll go over here because I saw this hand first. And then we'll work our way over this way and then towards the back.
Hi there. Thank you so much. This is so fascinating. New York Times last week did an expose on the amount of aquifers that are being drained in the United States through the oil and gas fracking industry. And I'm just wondering if that's also true in Canada, because it also seems to be fit into this kind of perfect storm that the water sources that we need to fight fires are being drained by the oil and gas companies.
Yeah. I mean, BC is, it's not quite the birthplace of fracking, but it is, you would not believe what's going on in northern BC right now. And they pioneered all kinds of horizontal drilling techniques, and it's fracking central. And, you know, we think of Canada as this incredibly watery place. You know, how could we ever run out of water? And we worry a little bit about selling it to the Americans, and that was an issue, I think, when Harper was in. But it's much more fragile and much more tenuous than we think it is. I mean, there are literally reservoirs in Alberta that are drying up right now because of the heat. They're drying up because of the heat. So that's separate from what you're talking about, but that is also an issue, what the water is used for. We have plenty of water, but industry, extractive industries, get a pass on the water. And one reason, bitumen mining, you know, it's tar up there. It's not oil. It is tar that you seal your driveway with, that they then melt with a heck of a lot of natural gas, is because it's so cheap. And the water is basically free. It's coming out of the Athabasca River. But as things heat up and as things dry up, it isn't just your laundry that dries faster. It isn't just the forest floor that dries faster. Lakes and rivers actually evaporate. I mean, it's happening in the Mississippi. It's happening in the Panama Canal, which is fed by fresh water. It cannot take big enough ships, as large ships as it used to be able to. It's happening in France. You know, these famous rivers, you know, are drying up. It's really makes your head spin, you know, and that's all related to the amount of CO2 that's now in the atmosphere that was not there naturally. And so water is that much more precious, every source of it, not just the surface water, but the aquifer water. And, you know, we all have to dial into that and realize, that is life and death for us, not just for firefighting, but for drinking, for growing crops that actually feed people rather than feeding cattle. And these are all, I mean, all of this is connected, and it's kind of overwhelming. So, you know, as far as being a citizen of Kingston, you know, I just invite you to consider what are some of the issues around here, you know, that you might be able to get sort of a toehold in, and focus on that, you know, and also focus on who you're voting for. But it's not as extreme up here because there are just fewer of us and there's more water. But there are a lot of things that happen in the States that eventually arrive in Canada. And, you know, we're often 10 years, 15 years behind, but I think these water shortages, you know, will become more pressing for us. And yeah, we've got the Great Lakes, we've got endless water, but no one's going to die of thirst, but it's going to exert pressures that won't be a lot of fun to try to remedy. So
that's good. Yeah. So we have a question here, then we'll go back here, and then we'll go over here. So over here, yep.
I'm sure I'm not going to sleep well tonight.
Sorry about
but
that.
But that's beside the point. Ontario wishes to build a lot of new homes. And you're speaking about the kind of material going into those homes. It sounds like another perfect storm.
It's an issue. And I think that this is something that we should take up with our city councils and with our firefighters. I mean, the thing is, firefighters are your allies. You know, they're really awesome people, and I don't know how often they get included in the conversation, and they've also seen it. All those folks are in touch with each other. You know, they've been talking to their brothers and sisters in Nova Scotia. They've been talking to their brothers. They go to the conferences. Yep. There was a fire chiefs conference that happened after Fort Mac, and, you know, it was like a giant therapy session, really. You know, these are fire chiefs. You know, these are solid, upstanding members of the community, but they were in there just with each other dealing with some heavy truths, you know? And I think it's really important to include them in the conversation. I don't know if there are any firefighters here tonight, but they've been coming to other readings that I've done, and we've done some Fire Smart videos and all that kind of thing. I really urge you to get connected to a Fire Smart program, which is a really good Canadian home safety program that can really mitigate the impacts of flying embers and things like that. And it's embers that get us. But what our houses are built out of, it's, you know, there are other things that they can be built out of that are affordable, that don't burn as easily. And there are also ways you can build and arrange houses so they're not as susceptible. And that hasn't really needed to be a consideration until you know, in Arizona and places in California, they're doing it already. So that would be a place to look southward for guidance. But it's, I think we've gotten all the freebies we're going to get, you know, as far as warnings. And we've had warnings aplenty, and none of us, you know, as I, you know, we're all downwind and we're all downstream. And so to act like that and build like that and plan like that, I think could save lives and make the 21st century a much more pleasant place for us to live and, you know, for our kids too.
And it's interesting because policy takes so long to catch up sometimes. You know, after Slave Lake, after Fort McMurray, there was a lot of discussion about this urban wildland interface or wildland urban interface. There are guidelines for how to manage for fire, you know, but they're only just released. Would that have, you know, prevented what happened in West Kelowna? Would that have prevented what happened in other communities? Probably not, because it takes so long for us to take it up. I know we've got a question.
Hi.
Hi. I was just going to say that I was in Chile at the end of November, early December. We were sitting in our living room, my husband and I have a house there because he's Chilean, looking at a distance, and there was a fire. And then an hour later, somebody was running through our house saying, "Vayate, evacuate, evacuate."
Wow.
And the fire, which was about an hour and 25 minutes south of Santiago, came that close to the studio, and the wind took it up the hill. But it was terrifying. The
wow.
President, Boris, who's very progressive, had anticipated there were helicopters every 15 minutes pouring water. 150 houses were burned. We picked up a man who'd lost everything. And yet, at the same time, there was a solidarity among the people as they were, you know, evacuating. And it was deeply moving. And the government afterwards built these little houses for people who'd lost their houses, which had small kitchens and toilets and stuff like that. So it is a world problem that we're working with.
Yeah. And it's really, there's a lot we can learn, not just from, I mean, I think honestly in Fort McMurray, they went back to business as usual. I think they just built the houses the same way, just bigger, because, you know, that is a province in denial. You know, they're so invested in petroleum and so invested in a 20th century status quo that, you know, they're captive to it. And I'm not sure we can look to them for guidance, but we can look to Chile, we can look to California, maybe we can look to Nova Scotia, I don't know. Or to Greece. I mean, and you know, there's a Greece is a complicated place too. There was I don't know how much of many of those fires were actually started by arsonists, but there's, you know, there's also a lot of conspiracy theories flying of, you know, just trying to pin the blame anywhere but on the actual cause. And so it's a tricky time that we're in that's going to bring out the best and also the worst in some of us. And you know, those of us, you know, who I think feel like we have a clear grip on it, though, you know, I think it's incumbent on us to make our voices heard and to stick together. And, you know, we're capable of making incredibly radical changes. You know, you all remember when you walked out of a bar stinking of cigarettes and you don't anymore, you know, and there was a time when that was unthinkable to not smoke in a bar. And when any behavior, especially a behavior that makes a lot of money for certain people, is integrated that deeply into our culture, it seems unthinkable to extract ourselves from it. Well, we're in a tobacco moment now with petroleum. And that lawsuit by Gavin Newsom in California, eighth biggest economy in the world, by the way, population to match Canada's, a lot more money, I'm pretty sure. And they're suing, you know, the big five oil companies. And that's a needle-moving event, and the big tobacco fought off lawsuits for years and decades in the 60s and 70s, but it finally got them, and they lost their social license and they lost their leverage. And now, you know, you see somebody smoking and you just think, you know, you poor sucker, you know. And you know, it's, moral judgment aside, it's just so clearly bad for you, and it doesn't make any sense. And it doesn't make any sense at the urban level, at the municipal or state or provincial level, to encourage or allow that behavior. And Gavin Newsom understands that facilitating petroleum development is going to make, you know, already State Farm has, you know, big insurance companies have said to the entire state of California, we're not insuring any new builds, business or domestic, for fire. And when I announced that in June, when the news very first dropped, I was up in Calgary, the whole room gasped. That's what made them gasp. None of the other things I said about what fire is doing in Alberta made them gasp. They were all listening. Great audience, you know, great, really good audience. But what really touched them was that bit of news, and that's interesting, you know. But it doesn't matter, really, just as long as you get it, you know, that this obsession with petroleum, this obsession with fire that Homo sapiens have, there are 8 billion of us, you know, we have changed the nature of the planet, and it's going to make certain aspects of our lives more difficult, including getting insurance in California, and I'm sure in Alberta, so.
I believe we have a question over here, and we will get to some of the ones at the back, too.
You anticipated my question. I was going to ask, you said Fort McMurray went back to normal, and I was going to ask, what happened to insurance rates?
Yeah, you know, that's a lapse on my part. I don't know the answer to that. I actually got to know some insurance agents up there, you know, who were overwhelmed by what happened. I think probably Fort McMurray did better on the insurance payouts and on the replacement than probably any other large disaster. And that's partly because it was the first big one for Canada, partly because of the prevalence of the petroleum industry, the leverage that the petroleum industry has on Alberta, and the feeling that the petroleum industry is so critical to the economy of Canada, which I would question. But all that said, I think that people generally did very well, even though it took a couple of years, you know, to get their places built. And you probably all know this, but you know, you can get full replacement if you rebuild where the house burned, and you get less money if you just want to get the payout and leave. But a lot of people left. Mm-hmm. But there are plenty of hurricane victims in Florida who wanted to get replacement and had to go to court to get 75% replacement instead of the 60% replacement that the insurance company was offering them. And that's what it's, you know, Canada may not have dealt with that to that degree yet, where you're having to sue the insurance company that you paid into for years and decades to try to get what they said they would do, and they only give you a fraction of it. So it's tough, you know, it's a tough business, and it's really under stress right now. And, you know, the one positive about the insurance industry is their data is pretty unbiased. They know how many houses burned versus how many houses burned 20 years ago. They know how much it costs, and they can read a thermometer. We all can.
Well, that is a really good example of kind of the path dependency, right? If the insurance company will only give you the full amount if you stay, well, you'll stay, or you'll have a big incentive to stay. In some cases, we might not want people to stay exactly where they are. We might want people to move.
Yeah, that's a really good point. And whether Lytton will ever be rebuilt, Lytton, BC,
right,
is whether Enterprise, Northwest Territories, will be rebuilt. There isn't big industry there. There isn't that support. There may be towns that just disappear from our landscape. And I was speaking to Paul A. Earst, who's, you know, in this book. They have a place in Athabasca, which is another forest town south of Fort McMurray, and they're selling that now because they're so afraid of it burning. And this is 7 years later, and the terror and uncertainty caused by Fort McMurray fire — this was before the fires got really bad this summer, I talked to him in the spring — and they're already, you know, so how do you have workers be comfortable in your province if they're terrified that they're going to get burned out? How do you even have an industry then if you have that kind of anxiety simmering under the surface? And that's just, you know, one person. That's anecdotal, but it's certainly not unique. And this other guy, you know, his house didn't even burn, but he bought himself a huge fifth-wheel trailer and he parked it down in Chandler, Arizona, in case the next fire burns him out. And think about that, the expense, the worry, the planning. You know, I cannot depend on this environment anymore. I cannot depend on the place that I used to call home anymore. That really undermining, when you think about that nationally, and the impacts of that, you know, just for our collective psyche, it's really undermining. And it's wrong. You know, we shouldn't have to worry about that. And so how we build, where we build, how we insure, what we burn or don't burn, all of that, you know, is up for question now, up for debate. And, you know, to me, there are some clear answers. But, you know, as you say, policy takes a while and people are where they are. And some people just won't believe it till they see it. And I cannot express strongly enough, you don't want to see it. You never want to see it.
No. We have a question over here.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for being here this evening and for your important book. It's just a privilege to listen to you both speak here this evening.
Thanks.
Sorry, closer? Oh. You talked in your book about the lessons that the firefighters from Slave Lake passed on in real time to the firefighters
yeah.
in Fort McMurray.
Yeah.
And you've spoken tonight in your book about the challenge of human beings imagining things they haven't experienced directly and being able to conceive of them. This emergency you're talking about, this planetary emergency you're talking about, what, and it may be beyond the scope of what you're comfortable speaking to, but what do you think about our evolutionary abilities to respond?
Well, you know what I think about, I mean, I'm really glad you asked that, and we're amazing. You know, we're amazing in our stubbornness to not see the obvious, but when it really hits the fan, like in the Prospect neighborhood of it was a Timberley on the night of May 4th, May 5th. So the fire's already been burning for more than 36 hours, just raging through the city. No signs of stopping, burning as ferociously in the middle of the night as it did in the hot day. You know, and that is climate change. Like the nights are different now, and so fire behaves accordingly. It's hot now. There's no dew. I can just keep doing my thing. And that's exhausting for firefighters, many of whom didn't sleep for 48, 56, you know, just a stupid number of hours awake and a very dangerous number of hours to be awake driving a fire truck. So those guys, they realized, wow, this water is not working on this fire because it just evaporates, you know, 100 meters before it touches a flame. So they said, we need bulldozers and backhoes, and we're going to start tearing houses down. And a house in Fort McMurray, you know, cost somewhere between $500,000 and $1,000,000. This was a brand new neighborhood, you know, full of smart homes, you know, with Alexas and Apple this and, you know, whatever you want in there. And they started, got bulldozers. You got those F-350s and those Mercedes, and they just plowed them through the walls of these brand new houses. And then the backhoes came and ripped them down. And I said, well, why'd you do that? And he said, well, because 15-foot flames of a flattened house are a lot easier to deal with than 85-foot flames of a standing house. So they bulldozed a fire break through the neighborhood. You know, it's shocking, you know, and I talked to the equipment operators. You know, no one interviews bulldozer drivers, but they have some interesting stories about the stuff they saw in those houses and the things that happened to them and that went on for them. You know, this is their guy's dream to own a house like that. It's only been inhabited for 6 months. And, you know, baby cribs are falling out and family photos are falling out and they're just trashing it. And it's sickening. It's an utter violation of everything that we are taught to value. And they had to see through that and just push through all that status quo and think in 21st century fire terms. And the only way you're going to save the rest of the neighborhood is by destroying tens of millions of dollars of brand new real estate. And everything in us tells us not to do that, especially if you're a firefighter. I'm going to save that house. Well, they realized after 36 hours of frankly getting their asses kicked that they couldn't. And so the only way to do it was in this incredibly radical way. So that was on the fly, under pressure, with having not slept in 2 days. They made that adaptation. So we can do it. And we really have to look at how politicians and social media is playing on us and manipulating us and dividing us and basically obfuscating. And it's honestly what oil companies have been doing since 1984 is, you know, look over there. And, oh, we're building a windmill over here. And, you know, Suncor has got their little buffalo pasture. You can see the tar sands from 10,000 kilometers up in space. You can't see the Mississippi River from there. You can't see LA from there. You can't see Shanghai from there. But if you know what you're looking for, you can see the tar sands. You know, we made a hell of an impact. Again, the amount of effort and ingenuity it took to do that and make it work year-round from, you know, 90 Fahrenheit to minus 50 Fahrenheit, these are technically capable people who work incredibly hard. And they did this thing that was almost impossible to do, and they actually made it strangely profitable. Mm-hmm. So we can do anything, really. But we got to get clear on what the planet allows and what the planet needs, and it's not all about us. And it certainly isn't all about the shareholders. And that's what's going on in the petroleum industry right now, is it's really, we're taking care of the shareholders. So, but we can do it. We can totally do it. And I could not, just so you know, I could not have written that book if I was totally fatalistic or depressed about the future. I got two kids, 19 and 22, and I recognize that we're gonna lose a lot. I recognize that a lot more is going to burn, but I also have real faith in our ingenuity, in part because of things I saw in Fort McMurray, and in our capacity to rally and function under pressure and do the right thing under pressure. I really think we have that in us.
Thank you for that. Anyway, we have time for a couple more questions. We have one at the back who's been very patient. I think to your right, put your hand up. Speaker, yeah, I think you wanted to have your hand up.
I was not one of the early ones. Let's give someone else a chance first.
Okay.
Sorry.
Put up your hands. Who wants to speak? Over here then. Sorry. We'll come back up.
Yeah, talking about that ingenuity, here in Ontario, there's a lot of money being poured into the electric car industry and batteries.
Yeah.
$12 billion announced a year or so. Just heard on the news today another $2.8 billion in Quebec. Is the electric battery industry a subsidiary of the fire industry, or is it part of the solution?
Wow, what a great, they sure burn like crazy when they catch on fire. No, I don't think they are. I think it's a step in the right direction, but this is the catch, you know, and when I see Joe Biden, you know, driving around in a Ford 150 electric Lightning, that is not the answer. That's not going to make the world better. And we, what World War II and the petroleum industry together kind of allowed us to have extraordinary expectations for what we deserve. It's really whatever you can buy, whatever you can afford, whatever you can mortgage, get a mortgage for, you can have. It's really kind of insane, but that's, you know, we've all grown up in that. That's the world, that's the logic we've grown up with. And, you know, never forget Dick Cheney saying, the American way of life is non-negotiable. Well, fire would beg to differ. And so would drought, and so would, you know, the last hurricane, Hurricane Ian. The American life way of life and the Canadian way of life are certainly negotiable. And so I think batteries and EVs are a step in the right direction. Like, it's better than a combustion car, than an internal combustion car. And keep in mind that the petroleum industry is a 19th century industry. The internal combustion engine was prototyped in 1860. It's an antique, and we're all still driving them, and that doesn't make any sense. But that it's the oil was cheap, petroleum industry is very powerful, the supply chain from, you know, the Gulf of Mexico and Saudi Arabia and Fort McMurray to our gas stations is extraordinarily well designed. It never fails. You know, when was the last time you ran out of gas that wasn't your fault? You know, it just doesn't happen in the developed world. And that's amazing engineering and planning and a lot of people showing up for their job every day. Well, imagine if those people showed up for their job every day developing renewable energy projects. And the other piece of this, though, that no one really wants to talk about is growth. And the idea of limiting growth is heretical. It's a heresy to say that. And it's political death to advocate for it as an elected official. And that is infantile. You know, you would never keep growing things inside your house until your walls blew out, you know, whatever that is, you know, that there are limits on the planet, and drought is making those limits. You know, there are a bunch of Spanish farmers in southern Spain who are not planting anymore. They gave up because southern Spain can't support a crop anymore. That's a huge country. A lot of food comes out of there. 90% of Florida's orange crop failed. 80% of Georgia's peach crop failed. There's a lot of failure going on, and people don't really want to talk about that, but it's all connected. We are not going to starve. Nobody has to starve. Nobody has to go thirsty, but we have to think about what we're entitled to, what really matters, and what really matters is the earth. It's like it's the sine qua non of everything we care about. And so to focus on that rather than just what we can take from it, you know, which is sort of the modus operandi of Fort McMurray and of so many, you know, and that's just the, you know, the cutting edge of it. But we're a lot of us are into that too. You know, what can I get? You know, how much can I afford? You know, I'll go to Walmart because my local hardware guy charges $3 more for that hammer, so I'll burn him and go buy it from, you know, and, you know, really short-sighted thinking that is just the way humans seem to work, and we respond to marketing in that way. So EVs and batteries are I think, a building block, but it's going to be a real mosaic of solutions. And if focusing on nurturing and repairing the earth and taking things from it and growing things on it that are essential rather than desirable or just profitable, you know, that those priorities, we have to evolve past that. And that's where I think Homo sapiens have been. It's kind of like, hey, mom, look what I did. I built the Great Wall. I built the tallest building. I built this giant mine. And mom, you know, the earth is now saying, you know, enough already. And so now the mama bear is like, you know, you're too old for that. You know, I'm not going to nurse you like that. You go out and find your own damn berries, you know. And so that's, you know, I think we're at an evolutionary stage of maturation. And it's a tough one because it's, you know, it's more fun just to say, hey, mom, look what I did, and have her say, you know, aren't you wonderful? And it's not so wonderful now. So that's, you know, that's a real realignment that's quite deep, you know, in our nature that I think we need to reconsider now. And it's not that we can't do it. We've been wonderful nurturers of the earth in the past. Yeah. We totally can do all this stuff. None of it's beyond our ability. So it's really choices and priorities.
So I'm very mindful of time. I know that we're coming to the end of the speaking event. I understand John will be signing some books at the back of the room, and I do encourage you to take advantage of that. I plan to take advantage of that. So reading this book, you know, I went into it thinking, okay, what am I in for? You know, I've studied this fire. I know it was bad. I know that climate change is driving it. Am I going to come out of this book with any hope? That's what I wondered. And I did. And I wondered, would I come out of this conversation with hope? And I am coming out with hope. And John, I really want to thank you for taking the time today. You've captured, I think, a really seminal moment in what's happening to our country and what's happening to the planet. You've written it in a way that's very accessible. And as I say, it doesn't leave me curled up in a ball under the bed. So it must be good.
Me neither, yeah.
And I really appreciate you taking the time to be with us all today.
Wow.
Thank you so much.
Thanks.
So very quickly, thank you again to John and Warren for that sobering but fascinating conversation, a very important topic, obviously. And yes, thank you for leaving with us with some hope as the last event of the night, you know.
Oh, to, wow, yeah.
To have something, it's a lot to think about, but really appreciate you coming here. As Warren mentioned, there are books available for sale next door, and if you have burning questions that you didn't have a chance to ask, then, you know, John will be in the back of the room. So, thank you very much, everyone.
And you just heard from a September 26th, a Kingston Writers' Fest event called Fire Weather. Author John Valent in discussion or conversations, probably a better word, with Warren, maybe referencing Valent's book called Fire Weather, The Making of a Beast. Again, the discussion centered around ideas about North America's oil industry, climate science, and how and why the devastation from forest fires is growing each year. And again, I did air this back in January, but looking for something to air this week because this is a pre-record and I'm not in studio. And also, I don't have a lot of material in the bank to create a new show. With the wildfires starting up this season, I thought this would just be a pretty important show to, and that a very important event to air again at this time. Again, just a reminder that every week, both hours of this show are uploaded to my blog space for it. Personal, I should say that, personal blog space for it at Finding a Voice on cfrcfm.wordpress.com. They will remain there for 3 years. I usually get that uploaded just before 7 p.m. in the evening after I get home. But again, as mentioned, since I'm tied up this afternoon, I'm also tied up this evening. And so it may not happen until quite late tonight or even tomorrow before I can get this uploaded to the blog space. My apologies for that. And I guess, well into it, officially, welcome back, I should say, into the second hour. And you are listening to Finding a Voice here on CFRC 101.9 FM. Again, we are located in Lower Carruthers Hall, Queen's University, Kingston, Ontario. My name is Bruce. I'm here every Friday afternoon from 4 to 6 o'clock. We do stream live online as well at www.cfrc.ca. And for the remainder of the show, I'll be sharing some information about upcoming calls and events, calls for submissions and upcoming events. Because there are always a few spots that, before I get into that even, there are a few spots that need airing each hour, and there wasn't a chance, obviously, to do that in the first hour. So I'll tell you what, let's do that right now, and then I will be right back.
Folk Everything is your passport to the finest in folk music. Old, new, and everything in between. The wonderful, the wild, and the weird.
Walk quietly by, he won't bother you. He's a busy man, he's got things to do.
It's all here Saturdays from 10 a.m. until 1 p.m. Folk Everything with Hugh on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston.
Our house is a very, very, very fine house.
Late in the 1970s, four Kingston women got together to discuss the idea of creating a community house, a place where grassroots organizations, families, and groups could gather. A place where food could be prepared and shared, new skills could be learned, and lively discussion could be encouraged. For over 30 years, Kingston Community House has provided low-cost meeting space for hundreds of groups, allowing people to come together to learn from one another, share resources, and trade skills. As it becomes safe once again to gather in person, we look forward to providing the Kingston community with a comfortable and convenient place to reconnect with one another. Located in downtown Kingston, we operate 7 days a week. For more information on Kingston Community House and how to book, please visit kingstoncommunityhouse.org.
Have you been dumped? Left all alone? Just want to find your soulmate? Look no further, because your new best friend is waiting for you at the Kingston Humane Society. The Kingston Humane Society is a nonprofit animal organization founded in 1884 that is supported solely by the community, receiving no government funding to assist in their mission of caring for injured, abused, and homeless animals, with the goal of creating families and homes for the animals. They are the only open shelter in the region, accepting every animal brought to them with compassion, respect, and humane assistance. If you want to donate to help these animals find their best friends, or if you're interested in finding the new love of your life, please visit kingstonhumanesociety.ca. Everyone just needs a little love.
Two out of three geese. Six out of seven seagulls. And this Transylvanian owl all agree that if they had their own radios, they would tune in to CFRC 101.9 FM. Broadcasting just for you from Kingston, Ontario, Canada.
And again, you are listening to Finding a Voice here on CFRC 101.9 FM. We are located in Lower Carruthers Hall, Queen's University, Kingston, Ontario. My name is Bruce. I'm here every Friday afternoon from 4 to 6 o'clock. We do stream live online as well at www.cfrc.ca. And as we're getting close to the end of the show, I mentioned that in the final, maybe 20 minutes, not quite, 15 anyway, I'm going to share some calls for submissions that are quickly expiring, actually. And also, there are some events happening in and around Kingston. I'm going to share a few of those as well. Coming up, first, let's do the calls for submissions. The first one is Award of Awesomeness. That's Art Poetry Magazine's Award of Awesomeness, and their deadline is always the last day of each month. That's open to all. Prize is 50% of prize money raised and a rare vintage award item. The link for this month's prompt and also the theme, just go to arcpoetry.ca/contest/ArcAwardOfAwesomeness, and you'll find it there. Again, last day of the month, so deadline is May 31st. Another call for submissions, Biblioasis, and from their website, I'm reading, Poets, get your collections ready. Biblioasis will be opening for submissions of manuscripts on Wednesday, May 1st, so that's been open for a while. And they will remain open, though, only until May 31st. I'm not quoting anymore. And or it says once they reach 200 submissions, whichever comes first. So that said, you might not want to wait until, you might want to act sooner rather than later. How's that? Manuscripts should be 48 to 100 pages. Full guidelines, www.biblioasis.com/biblioasis-opening for poetry submissions. Again, deadline ends May 31st. Also call for submissions from Brick Books. They're accepting submissions through May 31st. It says on their website, please pay attention to their submission guidelines because they may have changed. www.brickbooks.ca/about/submissions. Let's just go with that. That'll take you right to the page. Deadline again, May 31st, as mentioned. Also, CV2, Contemporary Verse 2's reading period is open. Their reading period is quite extensive from September 1st through May 31st. With that said, you can see it's about ready to expire. So if that's something you want to do, CV2, let me just give you their link for submissions. It's at https://contemporaryverse2.ca /submissions-guidelines. And let me just give you their full website in case I've kind of mucked up the sublink there. It's just a contemporary verse 2, and that's the numeral 2. I should have mentioned that in the first link as well. So again, https://contemporaryverse2.ca. Again, May 31st, a master's review anthology number, 13. They're looking for unpublished fiction or creative nonfiction. It says $7,000 will be awarded. I'm sure that covers a number of prizes and not just the first place prize, but I don't know that for sure. It says this anthology will be printed both in print and online. Please check their website, it says, for full details. And just, and again, it's https://. mastersreview.com/submissions. And those are the close ones. We've got some events coming up, so I'm going to roll into that next. Actually, there's one this evening, and I'm actually emceeing that event. That's part of the reason I'm not here this afternoon. And getting ready for this. And also, I'll be, and this is coming up anyway this evening. Catherine Owen, this is going to be a book launch, I should say, at the Novel Idea Bookstore, again, 156 Princess Street. It's right on the corner of Princess and Bagot. I think everybody knows where it is, but just in case, that's coming up again tonight at 7 p.m. Catherine Owen, who was originally from Vancouver, now in Edmonton, will be in Kingston to launch her new collection of poetry, Moving to Delilah, at Novel Idea on May 24th. And also joining will be Callista Markovtich, will be launching her debut collection. And Callista is local, launching her debut collection, Wrap in a Big White Towel. Again, I'll be emceeing, so hope to see you there. It'd be cool if you could make it out. There is another it's a relatively new poetry and music series called the Driftline Series. And the third installment of that will be happening this Sunday, May 26th. Wanda Pramsma has organized this new poetry music event, and this one will feature poets Phil Hall and Chris Turnbull, and they're both great poets. I know them. And they're not in Kingston, more in the Ottawa area. The featured musicians, though, I believe are all local. Foster Shea and Sudak. I know Savannah Shea and Anna Sudak. I'm not sure I know the other person, but I think they're all local. Find a bit more about the series here. www.instagram.com/drift. Line, all one words, DRIFTLINE series. And it's going to be held at Musiki, 73 Brock Street in Kingston. Again, Sunday, May 26th. That too will be at 7 p.m. And let's see what else we've got here. I've got a long list. Some of this might not be quite as important to this show as other things. I will mention this because there might still be places open. I'm just reviewing to make sure I'm not leaving something out that I could share. The coming up Saturday, June 8th, which is actually coming up fairly quickly too, it's a writing workshop. Lorna Crozier will be at Wintergreen Studios, and I'm reading from their website. It says, if you're drawn to poetry as a way of expressing the spirit within you and in the people, places, and things around you, this one-day workshop is for you. It says, everyone is welcome, beginners and published poets alike. Crozier will present a series of short calls in both the morning and afternoon sessions. You can get more information or to register, go to www.wintergreenstudios.com/events/passion. That is happening Saturday, June 8th, 9:30 a.m. to 4:30 p.m. And Wintergreen Studios is located at 90 Wintergreen Lane, South Frontenac, Ontario. And let's see what else I've got here. I do have a few listeners in Montreal in that area, so I'm going to go ahead and share this. I think this might be their final one through their spring. They had winter and spring dates, and this is the final one until they start a summer and fall season, and maybe they don't do a summer season. Anyway, this is a soiree. It's the Lawn Chair Series. Or I'm sorry, the Lawn Chair Soiree Series. And they will be gathering, as I mentioned, bi-monthly through these last two seasons. So this is the final one in their spring season. It's coming up on June the 20th. So you've got plenty of time. And if you happen to be either if you are in Montreal or happen to be in that area around that date, you might. It's a wonderful series. I've participated when it was during COVID, when it was all online through Zoom, and it's really wonderful. And it's, the organizers are incredible. This is happening on, I don't know if I said the exact time, Thursday, June 20th at 7 p.m. St. Anselm Chapel, Hollis Lounge, second floor, 1444 Avenue Union, Montreal, Quebec. And I don't know if I gave you the website, so I will do that. It said, I'm just going to read, well, let's see, let me focus on the paper here. If you want to learn more about the series and also more about this event, go to, they have a Facebook page. They also have a website, but that's mentioned on the Facebook page. So I just direct people to the Facebook page because sometimes it shows up faster there. www.facebook.com/groups/ and it is, I'm going to repeat this, it's a long numeric number, 7873541071. Again, that's 7873541071. And I'm saying that, but probably in the search bar, you can just type in the Lawn Chair Soiree series or even the Lawn Chair Soiree, and that should pull up their page, and then that will also pull up all the information you need to know about this. And let's see, and I have a lot of people, even local people, who go up to this and who actually have a place up there. There are a lot of small publishers here, independent publishers here. It's the Ottawa Small Press Book Fair, their spring edition in 2024. This is from, I'm going to go ahead and read from their event page. It says, note that it is a new location. And then, quote, once upon a time, way, way back in October 1994, Rob McClellan and James Spiker invented a two-day event called the Ottawa Small Press Book Fair and held the first one at the National Archives of Canada. Spiker moved to Toronto soon after our original event, but the fair continues thanks in part to the help of generous volunteers, various writers and publishers, and the public for coming out to participate. Admission to the public is free. So for more detail, go to www, and this is where I saw it, is on Facebook, www.facebook, lost my place here, www.facebook.com/events/another long number. You know what? I'm not going to do that. Just go to the Ottawa Small Press Book Fair, and I know that will pull up the page for it. I will tell you, since it is at a new location, that location is Tom Brown Arena, 141 Bayview Road in Ottawa. Again, I gave you the date, but not the time, I don't think. It's coming up Saturday, June 22nd from noon until 5 p.m. And I'll tell you what, at this point, we're getting, let's see if I've got one more thing. Well, you know what, I'm going to mention the two art festivals that are coming up. Because coming up starts on Wednesday, June 19th and runs through Sunday, June 23rd. The annual Skeleton Park Arts Festival. Go to their website. I'm sure they've updated information from what I have here. This is going to be held at McBurney Park, also known as Skeleton Park. You'll find it at Ordnance Street and Clergy. That's an intersection that dead ends into the park if you're coming up through Princess Street. Their page was still under construction the last time I looked, but go to, and you're going to get the latest information there, skeletonparkartsfest.ca, and you'll find it there. Again, that runs from Wednesday, June 19th through Sunday, June 23rd. Also, coming up the following weekend, I believe, is the annual Poets at Art, well, it should say Art Fest Kingston, that is a large festival that essentially takes up all of City Park. And City Park is at 79 Berry Street in Kingston, but it's also bordered by King Street and I think it's Bagot on the north. And I believe it might be West Street on the east side, which is confusing. But anyway, it's a big park. You can't miss it. Part of that, though, we're going to be having our 10th annual event called Poets at Art Fest. We've been doing that for 10 years. That will feature somewhere around 50 featured poets over the course of 3 days, from June 29th through Monday, July 1st. It's an outdoor poetry festival, includes an intuitive writing workshop. There's going to be a book launch with for an anthology called More Than a Gallerine, which is a collection of work from those who were featured readers and also participants in other things there last year. So pretty soon there's going to be a Facebook event page for that, so watch for it. It's probably... it might be even up there at this point. I'm recording this a few days ahead of time, but I'm hoping to get that done as well. Anyway, it's about time for me to check out here. We are very close now to the end of the show. I'd like to thank, as I always do, the Kingston Arts Fest, Kingston Writers Fest, for all the work they do for literature and art and for... the wonderful event that I aired for you today. You are and have been listening to Finding a Voice here on CFRC 101.9 FM. We are located in Lower Carruthers Hall, Queen's University, Kingston, Ontario. My name is Bruce, and I'm here every Friday afternoon from 4 to 6 o'clock. We do stream live online at www.cfrc.ca. And just my usual end of the hour mention, both hours of this show are uploaded to my blog space, personal blog space for it, at Finding a Voice on cfrcfm.wordpress.com. We'll remain there for 3 years. And do stay tuned. Coming up at the top of the hour, please stay tuned for 2 hours of East Coast music in a show called Saltwater Music, hosted by Rob Carnell. And here are a few recorded announcements to get us there. Thank you again so much for tuning in today, and take care. I will catch you here next week. Thanks.
Friday evenings at 6 p.m. here on CFRC, listen to Saltwater Music, a show covering all musical genres from the East Coast of Canada. Celtic, of course, but also rock, jazz, blues, folk, and a lot more. I'm your host, Rob Carnell. Tune in to Saltwater Music Friday evening from 6 to 8 here on CFRC 101.9 FM. or you can catch us on the web at www.cfrc.ca. And for our listeners out east, that's 7 p.m. Atlantic and 7:30 Newfoundland.
Wouldn't it be wonderful if you could borrow a musical instrument free of charge, just like you can borrow books from your local library? We think